Okay, so my guest today is Tom Lin. Tom is a professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. His research and teaching expertise are in the areas of corporations, securities regulation, financial technology, financial regulation, and compliance. Professor Lin and his research have been published and cited by numerous leading law journals and have been featured in the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg News, and the Financial Times, among other media outlets. Prior to entering into academia, Professor Lin practiced law at the New York State Office of the Attorney General and Davis, Polk, and Wardwell in New York City. So yeah, I'd just like to welcome you to the show, Tom.
John, thank you so much for having me.
So yeah, I'm glad you could join me for this conversation today, Tom, because we're going to talk about some of the great work that you've been doing on fintech, financial technology, or as you call it, cyborg finance. Now, I think you're probably one of the first legal academics to really focus on this as a major topic of concern, particularly when it comes to the regulation and design of financial markets. And you've developed your thoughts on the topic over a series of articles that have been published in the past 5 years. Many of these have titles starting with the new something or other, for example, the new investor in 2012, the new financial industry in 2014, and the new market manipulation in 2017. Now, there are lots of important ideas contained in these articles. I use some of them actually in classes that I teach. I mentioned that to you before in some of our correspondence. And for the purpose of today's conversation, we're only really going to focus on a handful of the important topics that you raise. Let me start by asking a general question about the lay of the land when it comes to fintech. You use the phrase the rise of cyborg finance to describe some of the changes in the financial sector over the past 20 to 30 years. So perhaps you could explain what you mean by this term and maybe give some examples of how cyborg finance has arisen.
So cyborg finance is a term that I coined, which attempts to encapsulate the fact that a financial industry once dominated by humans has evolved over time into one where humans and machines really share dominion over that industry, where the key new participants in finance are really cyborgs. They're part human and part machine. And so modern finance is essentially becoming cyborg finance. And we see examples of this transformation in almost every significant sector of the financial industry. Take two areas, trading and financial advising, as examples. So in terms of trading, algorithms conduct the bulk of securities tradings in the world now. Often these trades are done without any human intervention post-installation at speeds previously unimaginable. So that's one area where we see the emergence of cyborg finance. In terms of advising, robo-advisors are helping more and more people save for retirement through the ease of a few taps on their smartphones without ever visiting an office or speaking to a stockbroker or a financial advisor. Right. And decades ago, we probably couldn't imagine that happening. And now more and more folks are using robo-advisors instead of actual human financial advisors. So the rise of cyborg finance is unfolding all around us. And I think we're only in the very early stages of this transformation.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard some of the ads recently. They're on some podcasts, in fact, for these automated trading, I don't know how to describe them, like platforms or advisors, so that for individual investors, they can basically automate a particular trading strategy through an app on their iPhone or smartphone.
Correct.
Yeah. And this seems to be, I mean, there's an advantage to doing this insofar as it seems like the strategy that's employed automatically is one that's better than humans would tend to apply themselves, because humans are biased in various ways. So there's possibly a gain to be accrued to investors by automating their trading strategy in this manner.
Correct. And the other sort of key benefit to robo-advisors relative to traditional advisors is that if you don't have a sophisticated investment strategy, robo-advisors could offer you, plain vanilla strategies at much lower costs, because they don't have the same kind of costs infrastructure as traditional advisors. Right? They don't have to have offices. They don't have to have a ton of financial advisors on staff. And so artificial intelligence and user-friendly apps could take care of a lot of needs for investors who don't have sophisticated or complicated investment strategies.
Yeah, I like the term cyborg finance for one main reason, which is that the concept of the cyborg has always been bound up in a human-machine relationship. And so it carries a different set of connotations to other terms, like the term that I just used, such as automation, which seems to imply that there's a machine takeover of the financial sector. And I think that's not really the argument that you're making. It's more that there's a changed partnership between humans and technology in the financial sector. But the humans are still very much involved in the process and integrated into that process, just in a different way.
Absolutely. I think, you know, with the advancement of new financial technology, there is a legitimate concern that at some point the machines are not going to need us and take over completely. But I think we're still a long ways away from that. Humans still remain a critical component of any successful financial endeavor.
Now, what explains the rise of cyborg finance? In one of your papers, I think it's the new financial industry, you argue that it's the consequence of a technology regulation feedback loop, if I'm reading your argument correctly anyway. So perhaps you could maybe explain the mechanics of that feedback loop. How have we got to the current situation?
So the feedback loop is one of several sort of key factors that helps to explain the rise of cyborg finance. I don't think there's sort of one factor alone that explains this rise. So it's really a combination and a confluence of factors. Chief among them, I think, it's sort of information technology innovation, regulation, and competition. So the exponential rate at which information technology has improved just in the last decade alone has been pretty astounding. If you think about it, the iPhone has only been around for the last 10 years, and now we really cannot imagine a world without the iPhone or smartphones. So the technological innovation leaps and bounds in the last decade alone is one of the key factors for the rise of cyborg finance, because the technology has made it possible for industry participants to leverage artificial intelligence to do a lot of the works that previously took teams of humans hours, weeks, and days to do, and machines can now do them in seconds or minutes. Second, I think regulation has played a key role, and I think this is, you know, what you were alluding to in terms of the regulation technology feedback loop. As institutions try to figure out ways to leverage technology to comply with and to sidestep new regulation, there are going to be new opportunities for disruption and innovation. As institutions and firms think about ways to better comply or better avoid compliance with new regulation, and oftentimes they're using technology to help them with their compliance mechanisms. And third, I think the third key factor is competition. Right? It goes without saying that there's a ton of money involved in the financial industry, domestically here in the U.S. and internationally. And it's an incredibly competitive industry. So as a result, I think financial firms are constantly trying to figure out new ways to gain a slight edge on their competitors. And more that edge has come via artificial intelligence and advanced information systems. So I think a confluence of innovation in information technology, regulation, and competition in the financial industry has really helped serve as catalysts for the rise of cyborg finance.
Yeah, I think maybe we might come back as well to the regulatory side of things a little bit later on when we talk about some of the problems that this gives rise to and ways in which regulators should possibly respond to the rise of cyborg finance. But let's move on to discuss maybe some of the consequences of this shift towards cyborg finance, and particularly the idea of systemic risk that arises from the use of machines in financial systems. Now, that phrase systemic risk has been used widely to talk about threats to the financial system definitely since 2008, possibly before that. I'm just not familiar with the debate really before 2008. My financial awakening was in 2008, really. I wasn't paying much attention to the financial sector before then.
I think that's the case with many people.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, I guess it was particularly a salient event since it was right when I finished my college education. I was just starting my PhD at the time, so had a fairly dramatic formative influence on me. But yeah, anyway, this phrase systemic risk was used to discuss some of the problems that arose at the time. And now you think that new kinds of systemic risk are arising from the use of cyborg finance. So maybe we could try and probe this idea in a little bit more depth. First, could you define the concept of a systemic risk and maybe give an example that people would be familiar with?
Sure. So systemic risk for the purposes of the financial industry generally refers to the idea that some factor or triggering event could destabilize the entire financial system. The systemic risk that is probably most well known following the financial crisis of 2008 is probably the systemic risk of too big to fail. Right? This is the notion that certain large financial institutions, namely large banks, are too important to the stability of the financial system that we can't allow them to fail. Right? And as a result, governments in the United States and throughout Europe have to step in whenever these large financial institutions seem unstable or fragile to make sure that they survive and thrive so that the entire system survives and thrives.
Right. So, I mean, banks like Lehman Brothers or insurers like AIG, they would have been identified at the time as financial institutions that are too big to fail because they have links embedded. So their reach is so great within the financial sector that if they
Correct.
Fall down, lots of things fall down. I think the analogy used at the time was the idea of the house of cards. The whole thing starts.
Right. And, you know, the two institutions that you named sort of highlights the issue of too big to fail in a pretty clear way. Right. So one institution, Lehman Brothers, we let go into bankruptcy. We let go under, and we saw sort of the cascading destabilizing effects of Lehman Brothers' collapse. The other institution, AIG, we decided to bail out to make sure that what happened in the aftermath of Lehman doesn't happen should AIG fail. And so there is legitimate debate and legitimate disagreement about whether those policy choices were correct or not. But those two institutions and the regulatory actions taken in connection with them highlights what regulators were thinking at the time in terms of systemic risk, particularly with too big to fail institutions.
Yeah, I just maybe want to ask a question about this, though, which is perhaps more conceptual or empirical before we move on to discuss how this arises in the case of cyborg finance. How widely supported is the notion of too big to fail or systemic risks more generally? I mean, are there really such things that are systemic risks? I mean, how much of the system does it need to affect before it is classified or qualifies as a systemic risk? Or is this really a fuzzy notion and that we identify some things or classify some things as a systemic risk, and then at that point it becomes maybe a self-fulfilling prophecy that because everyone believes it's a systemic risk, it does become too big to fail. And so we have to do something about it. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's definitely no clear numerical bright line cutoff for, you know, an institution to deem it, you know, if you have X number of dollars in market cap, then you are too big to fail. And so I think it's an imprecise judgment that policymakers, using the tools that are available to them, the information that is available to them at that time, make the judgment that, you know, this institution is too important to the system for it to fail. And so in some ways, I think you're correct that it's really a more fuzzy judgment than a clear, precise judgment. And that in making that judgment in and of itself, there could be intended and unintended consequences. Meaning that once you designate an institution as too big to fail, the world sees it differently and the institution sees itself differently.
Yeah, right. So that's when you get the potential for a self-fulfilling prophecy because the institution itself believes it can act with a degree of impunity. I guess the technical economic concept here would be moral hazard.
Yes, that's the term that was bandied about a lot during the financial crisis and in the aftermath of it.
Yeah, I mean, I should say that that's not that unusual because these problems of self-reflexivity, self-reflexive judgments and self-cascade effects are common in financial markets. So, it's not that unusual to get these self-fulfilling prophecies in the financial sector. Let me move on then to systemic risks that arise from cyborg finance. Now, you identified two new systemic risks in one of your articles. The first of them is the idea of the system being too linked to fail. So maybe you could start by just explaining what that systemic risk is and how it might arise.
Sure. So in terms of too linked to fail, I think because of the interconnected and interdependent nature of the new high-tech financial industry, a disruption to certain firms that serve as important nodes in the financial system could lead to systemic damage. Now, this is distinct from too big to fail because the systemic risk of too linked to fail includes smaller institutions whose distress or failure may ripple across the system because of their linkages, regardless of their size or their market value. So, one would think about these firms as small but important parts in a larger system, like spark plugs in a car or hinges on a door.
Yeah, so they're essential cogs in the machinery, so to speak. But
yes,
their actual size could be relatively small, but if you take them out, it could have these ripple effects across the system.
Yeah, like the tiny gear in the big machine that people take for granted, but without that little gear, all of a sudden the machine doesn't work as smoothly.
Yeah, or something like the keystone in an arch or something like that. So
yes.
The bridge falls down just as a result of one stone. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, are there examples of this arising already, this issue of too linked to fail?
We haven't had a sort of catastrophic event related to it, but we've seen small episodes of it. So a couple of years ago, Bloomberg terminals malfunctioned in the middle of a trading day. Now, Bloomberg, by the way, is a financial news and information company. It's not a large banking institution. But because so many bond traders use the Bloomberg terminals in their day-to-day operations, the fact that there was a malfunction with Bloomberg terminals really affected the multi-billion-dollar bond market during that day.
Yeah. So, I mean, it seems to me that the idea of too linked to fail would only arise in the case of particular actors who are, in a sense, hubs or connection points for lots of different inputs. They're relaying a lot of information through the financial market, or a lot of trades come through them, even though they might be a relatively small player. One thing about networks is, at least in theory, the original design of the internet or something, the idea was that by it being networked and having no central repository or hub or location, it was relatively resilient.
Correct.
So what you're pointing to here is a flawed design of a, it's not necessarily an intentional design either, but a flawed design in the financial market where you might have these small players who are these hubs, these centralized hubs for the relay of information or capital or whatever through the financial system.
Yes. So part of it is, sort of their position, as you said, sort of the hub and wheel network structure. The other part of it is that so much of the operations of the financial industry is interdependent on counterparties. And so much of the trading and so much of the interactions between firms are now run via artificial intelligence. And so that if one of the counterparties is not functioning with integrity, the feedback effects and the cascading effects could ripple through the entire system. And it need not be a large institution.
Yeah, actually, so that's another important point. So you get these cascade effects again. I mean, part of that is driven by the way in which everybody responds to the things that everybody else is doing. And so a small mistake or error in the information that's being fed through the system or the machinery of the system can have these widespread ripple effects just because of the way in which there's this reflexivity within the system as well.
Yeah, and this sort of ties nicely into the second systemic risk that I highlighted, this notion of too fast to save.
Right? Yeah.
So financial transactions today occur at velocities measured frequently in milliseconds, which is thousands of a second, which is about 100 times faster than the blink of an eye. While there are benefits to these astounding velocities, there's also an increased risk of error, volatility, and market misconduct before anyone can intervene or prevent the damage. And as you alluded to, because many of these firms engage in similar or interdependent strategies, a technological failing of one product or one participant could create vicious cycles of volatility for the entire financial system, right? Because of cascade effects and feedback loops. And so we saw this in 2010 with what is now known as the flash crash, right, which was allegedly caused by a single errant trade. In less than 30 minutes, approximately $1 trillion in market value vanished from the U.S. stock market. And a few years later, in 2014, we saw a similar flash crash in the market for U.S. treasuries.
Yeah, and I mean, there have been a couple of other events, I think, last year.
Yes.
That have been labeled flash crashes as well. I mean, the term is perhaps becoming a bit confusing now, since it's used to refer to that original event in 2010 and then also subsequent mini flash crashes, so to speak, that have emerged in subsequent years.
Yes.
I mean, what do you think we've learned from those past instances? So I think, I mean, they're an example of this problem of too fast to save, where you get these sudden high magnitude events in the market. But I mean, like, how much damage do they really do? I mean, is it not the case that people just respond to them by saying, oh, okay, something weird is happening in the market. This isn't normal behavior. So we just need to correct the problem. We don't need to treat this as a real proper trading, but it basically irons itself out over time, even though there is this immediate effect.
Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, one thing to glean from these flash crashes is that there's still a lot that we don't understand about how this high-tech financial industry operates. So that's the first thing. There's a lot of unknowns. Second thing, I think, is, you know, while you're correct in saying that if you are patient and just ride out the seconds, minutes, or hours of volatility, you would likely be fine. But at the same time, you might become a little more disillusioned about the integrity of the system. And you might lose some of the confidence you have in the stability of the system if this happens more frequently. The third thing, I think, is it really should encourage people to think more long term and be more patient when it comes to investments. So if you're a patient investor, what happens in the span of milliseconds or minutes or even days or weeks should not affect your investment calculus whatsoever. So I think those are three things one could glean from flash crashes of the last few years.
Yeah, and I mean, part of this, I guess, that then also has to do with how we design the market itself. This is something you allude to, but it seems to me that a lot of the changes that have occurred within the financial system, and, you know, the way in which share prices affect corporate behavior, have been tending towards this short-termism. There's more of an emphasis on, you know, quarterly profitability or the quarterly statement of earnings to shareholders as being a key indicator of the success or failure of a corporation, even when over the long term that might not have that much significance. But yeah, there seems to be this trend towards short-termism in general, and then this too fast to save problem and, you know, high frequency trading, this more and more competition in the short term is kind of the apotheosis of this more general trend in how we've set up the market. Do you have any comments on that idea?
Yeah, I think it's really tough to be a public company in this day and age, because you have to balance sort of long-term investments and long-term strategy with market demands for short-term results. And if you are not careful in sort of balancing those two demands, what you end up seeing is companies making short-term results-oriented decisions that end up costing them much, much more in the long run. For instance, foregoing investments in the short term so that they can beat earnings and the current quarter or the next quarter, but by foregoing investments in the near term, they end up losing market position down the road to a more patient competitor.
Right. And so, I mean, are there ways in which we can improve the design then of a financial system to encourage more long-termism? Like, I mean, specifically in relation to the issue of cyborg finance, I guess, change the market design so that we can avoid this problem of too fast to save.
I think it would be really hard. I think there would be a lot of political resistance to any attempts to regulate in a heavy-handed way the marketplace in that fashion. I think what's more important is to change the expectations of investors, to have investors think on a more long-term basis and to not measure results on a day-to-day basis or a week-to-week basis, but really think about investments on a year-to-year basis.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me, though, in that digital technology in general seems to encourage a more short-term focus. I mean, just thinking myself, you know, I probably don't need to reload my Twitter feed every minute or two to see if I've gotten any more retweets, or check my Facebook feed every couple of minutes to see if I've more posts have been liked. I mean, if I was being rational about it, I could check it maybe once a day or a couple of times a week. But I seem to be addicted to the short-term information, and you know, the nice kind of hit of dopamine I get from the expectation of the reward. And I guess the same problem is emerging really in the financial market, that people are addicted to the constantly updated stream of information and reacting in the short term. And yeah,
correct. Most stock tickers are, you know, are done in real time. I don't think a stock ticker that shows changes in prices on a monthly basis or a weekly basis running across the TV screen would be very popular.
Yeah, so I think that also maybe underscores how hard a problem this is, insofar as, you know, you're not just dealing with a problem in the financial sector alone. It's more of this just general trend across all of our lives towards short-termism and the short-term rewards of digitally supplied information. Let's move on to discuss another issue here that arises from cyborg finance. In one of your papers, you talk about how the existing system of financial regulation is premised on the belief that investors are rational in some defined sense, which we might talk about in a moment. But you argue that this premise, this idea of the rational investor or reasonable investor, is called into question in light of developments in cyborg finance. So why is this?
So for a long, long time, the central character and protectee of much of financial regulation is someone called a reasonable investor. Right? The reasonable investor is frequently envisioned as a rational human being of average wealth and ordinary financial sophistication that invests passively for the long term via educating themselves and by reading disclosure documents. Right? So obviously, the reasonable investor is not an actual person, but it's still an incredibly instructive model for building financial rules and regulations. But this convenient fiction in many ways obscures a larger, more complex truth about today's diverse population of real investors. Now, this conception of a rational, reasonable investor has been questionable in light of a lot of behavioral economic studies that highlight the irrationality of humans in all sectors of their lives, not just finance. And with the rise of cyborg finance, I think this model investor, this rational, reasonable investor, is even losing more salience, as so much of investing and trading is driven by algorithms and artificial intelligence, not humans reading disclosure documents and then educating themselves and then executing trades.
Yeah, I mean, my intuition on this would be that it would actually go the other way. So I'm just wondering why my intuition is wrong. So my sense is that the design of an algorithmic trading strategy, for example, would be more likely to conform with the dictates of you know, rational choice theory or rational investment theory. I mean, you can actually literally program an algorithm to follow some trading strategy that's been dreamt up by an economist. Whereas the ordinary reasonable investor, that might not be a legitimate expectation because of all the quirks and biases in the way in which they reason, which have been worked out by behavioral economic or economists. So, I mean, why is the automated or algorithmic trader less rational?
I don't think they're less rational. I just think that model investor, the reasonable, rational investor, this passive investor of ordinary financial sophistication, that doesn't match really well with investing or trading platform based on artificial intelligence that is executing trades via high-frequency mechanisms based on a plethora of information beyond disclosure documents filed with the SEC or other relevant financial regulators.
Yeah, so actually, I guess really the emphasis here should be on the term reasonability as opposed to rationality. Mm-hmm. That's my error in the way I've asked the question. So the reasonable investor is more of a generic human being who operates on the kinds of information that generic human beings find important and operates over time scales that are human, whereas the algorithmic trader, in a sense, might be actually hyper-rational. Or,
correct. Yeah. So the new technology, I think you're correct in suggesting that could lead to more rational investing. At the same time, the new technology could also lead to more irrational investing and trading, right? Because it's so easy to execute a trade via your smartphone with two or three simple taps during periods of boom or volatility. You might end up executing a lot more trades than you otherwise would have if you had to go visit your financial advisor or talk to your stockbroker, as folks had to do decades ago.
Yeah, so I mean, again, that kind of human-machine partnership is important to bear in mind here as well. It's not just the machine operating on its own. It's the opportunities that are afforded to us by the machine will also change how ordinary human investors might behave as well.
Yes.
Yeah, and just an interesting connection here with another interview I did recently on the regulation of self-driving cars. It occurs to me as you've described this idea, which is that, you know, one of the issues there are around what decisions should a self-driving car make in a crash scenario. Should it swerve to kill an elderly person or collide with a child or a teenager? You know, these interesting moral dilemmas that arise. And a point that was raised by another researcher, Hinyan Liu, in an interview I did with him, was that there might be a problem with a fleet of self-driving cars implementing, you know, a precise version of utilitarianism, that it might have these bizarre structural consequences that we find that lots of elderly people are suddenly dying or dying at a disproportional rate because,
yes.
Because the rational strategy, the rational utilitarian strategy has been multiplied across the market or across the system. And the same issue really could arise with cyborg finance, that we get the, because we're used to humans who are full of quirks and biases and they all kind of average out in the end, we're not used to maybe the implementation of this hyper-rational approach. And it could have these interesting structural consequences for the market, which really would change how we have to regulate the market.
You know, as I alluded to earlier, I think, you know, technology will play a big, big role in the future of finance. But at the same time, I think humans will likely remain the critical factor, if not one of the most important factors in financial operations for the foreseeable future. Because machines, no matter how artificially intelligent, are still not as smart as humans, right? The human brain with its billions of neurons and trillions of synaptic connections remains one of the most sophisticated, complicated, and powerful of all analytical machines out there. And so the machines, no matter how smart, still requires us to create their initial operating systems and codes and human interactions that implicate values and empathy and ethics, as you suggested, are going to remain key ingredients to any successful or disastrous, you know, financial endeavor. To put another one more bluntly, you know, smart machines and artificial intelligence still stand very little chance against whimsical humans and natural stupidity. So I think just like in the automated car space, I think, you know, some of the toughest and perhaps most rewarding questions about the future of finance have less to do with technology itself, but have more to do with what kind of human values and ethics do we want to embed in this new financial technology that governs our money going forward.
Yeah, and I mean, this then kind of relates to another problem which you discuss in your most recent article. Now, I haven't had a chance to actually read this in detail, but you discuss maybe new problems that arise in market manipulation from the use of cyborg finance. So obviously, the idea of market manipulation is an old one, and people should be familiar with it. And I've discussed it in two of my previous interviews, so we don't need to revisit the basic concept. But what could the new problems in market manipulation be with the rise of cyborg finance?
Right. So market manipulation has been around since markets have been around. And they're only limited. The forms of market manipulation are only limited by the imagination and deviousness of the human participants in those markets. So in contrast to what I would call analog traditional market manipulation, which involved unscrupulous humans interacting with one another, new market manipulation generally uses electronic communications, information systems, and algorithmic platforms of the new high-tech financial marketplace to unfairly distort information and prices. So I've called this new type of market manipulation cybernetic market manipulation because at its core, these distortive actions and effects tamper with the humans and computerized information and communication systems of the marketplace. They corrupt how humans and machines communicate between and amongst each other in the financial markets. And because the marketplace now is so reliant on information technology, parties can manipulate the marketplace through things like fake regulatory filings, fictitious news reports, erroneous data, and hacking in ways that previous markets were just not vulnerable to in the same way.
I think I used examples in previous episodes about the way in which some of these systems, as you say, feed fake news or fake information into the market. And obviously then you get the cascading effect as everybody responds to that new information. In fact, I think I recall that one suggested flash crash was the consequence of a response to a tweet, a fake tweet
yes.
of some kind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a lot of these trading platforms feed into certain Twitter feeds. And so if someone can manipulate the Twitter feed of the Associated Press or the White House, they could have, in the very short term, an impact on the market.
Okay, so, I mean, this raises then the next question that I wanted to ask you, which has to do with, to what extent are the issues or threats posed by technology and cyborg finance really new threats, or are they just old threats in a new guise, or does that distinction really make any difference? This is something that comes up time and time again, I find, in debates about technology and its impact on society, is whether there are genuinely new problems that arise or just really slightly different variations on old problems. And I mean, it might be important in one sense if we need new tools or concepts to deal with them, maybe new laws to deal with cybernetic manipulation. But do we need new tools or concepts to deal with them? And how new are these threats?
The answer is both, in the sense that some of these threats are amplifications or mutations of previous threats. Right? In some instances, new financial technology simply amplifies old risks, like the use of fake information to manipulate markets. In other instances, new financial technology creates new risks, like those involving cybersecurity, hacking, and high-frequency trading. And so it's really a combination of both old risks mutated and genuinely new risk. And in terms of our response to it and the tools that we need, I think a similar dual track approach is necessary, in the sense that old tools and old ideas need to be updated. For instance, in law, the notion of criminal intent for financial fraud needs to better account for a world where artificial intelligence super machines are making so much of the decisions. With no real criminal intent or any intent, at all. It's really an amoral, code-driven execution. At the same time, I think new tools and new ideas are needed. Regulators certainly need better technology to match the technology of the industry participants that they're attempting to regulate. And conceptions that reflect the cybernetic nature of finance, where humans and machines work inextricably together, are also needed. And so I think, you know, one of the chief tasks for policymakers, regulators, and academics in this area in the coming years really centers on how do we figure out the best way to upgrade a 20th century financial infrastructure for the financial innovations of the 21st century. And going back to your example of the question surrounding automated cars, it's really akin to making sure that a transportation system built for a world of horse-driven or horse-drawn carriages is safe and stable and sustainable for a world of high-speed self-driving cars.
Yeah, I think that's a useful way of kind of framing the general problem and how we need to respond. Maybe we could just wrap up with some more specific examples of principles that should guide the new regulation of the new financial industry. I mean, one of your papers, The New Financial Industry, you outline a series of principles that you think should operate in the regulation of financial markets. Now, maybe you do remember all these, maybe you don't. I know myself from having written articles, I don't always remember everything that's in them. But maybe you could discuss some of the solutions to this problem, some of the key principles that need to be operative.
So, you know, the complexity involved in sort of drafting regulations to respond to a rapidly changing dynamic industry is incredibly tough. But I think, you know, there are some core principles that we should be thinking about. So, you know, one would be figuring out ways to enhance coordination among the multiplicity of regulators out there, both within a country and globally. How do we make sure that U.S. regulators coordinate and work better with European regulators? Because financial institutions now operate across the world. Another principle to be thinking about is, you know, how do we figure out ways to incentivize better behavior from financial firms? Frequently, we think about regulation as ways to punish and ways to prevent bad behavior. And so flipping that around, you know, we should also be thinking about ways to incentivize good behavior. Another sort of key principle that I talked about in my research is to figure out ways to enhance disclosure. Right? So if the reader of disclosure isn't some ordinary human being of regular financial sophistication, but really smart artificial intelligence platforms, how do we make it so that these disclosure documents and the contents contained therein are more user-friendly for the machines to process and quote-unquote read, since they're the ones using the information?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that's actually, that raises some interesting ideas about around the transparency of the financial system more generally, because what might make sense and what might be comprehensible to a machine may not be what makes sense and is comprehensible to a human investor. So you probably need both information packaged in human-friendly forms and in machine-friendly forms.
Mm-hmm. And the SEC is making some efforts in doing that. Yeah, they're making a lot of the disclosures more machine readable in some ways. But beyond, you know, beyond regulatory principles, I think embedded deeper in the core of your question is really a question of values. And what kind of values do we want our governing structure to have over the financial industry? And so some of the things at the core of this question are values like stability, growth, opportunity, and fairness. And how do we balance these competing values? Right? Do we want a system that is incredibly stable but very low growth? Do we want a system that's very high growth but very volatile? And so I think at the core of your question is a question about values. What kind of values do we want our rules and regulations to reflect?
Yeah, I know. I agree that that is probably the most important question, but it's also possibly the most difficult thing to figure out or to reach any consensus or agreement on.
Absolutely.
Obviously, the particular tools that we use to implement a regulatory strategy should be informed by values. But yeah, figuring out whether we want stability or high growth or fairness or more efficiency, I mean, these are, I think, perennial questions, which I guess illustrates how no matter how much the new technology changes the dynamics of the market, it all boils down to these fundamental questions around values.
That humans ultimately have to decide. I think the technology going forward is going to be pretty incredible and, you know, things that we can't imagine at the moment. And it's going to hold with it great promise. The bigger question is whether the policymakers, the regulators, the politicians, using sort of analog human methods, can figure out a way to regulate and work with all the new financial technological tools that are going to be coming on the horizon.
Yeah, and I think maybe our faith in political institutions to respond intelligently to new technologies is perhaps been called into question in recent times.
It's an open question.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good place to leave it, because that's opening a whole other can of worms. I'd just like to thank you for joining me for this conversation, Tom.
Thank you so much, John. This was a lot of fun.